Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're joined for the first part of this program by Sherrilyn Ifill, a noted civil rights lawyer, author of the book On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, and professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, who joins us to talk about what's going on in Eric Holder's Department of Justice and what they're doing at the Civil Rights Division and why it may be so historically important. The number here is 410-319-8888. And Sherrilyn, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Mark.
So what is going on? This is like a, if there was ever an administration that created a gigantic sea shift in how they were going to run the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice, it was Bush's administration, probably more than any administration in our modern history.
Well, there's no question about it that the Bush administration engaged in practices that politicized the Department of Justice in ways that were entirely unprecedented before that administration. And one of the understandings among many supporters of President Obama was that his election would mean a return to the core mission of the Justice Department, which was the protection and promotion of civil rights. The Bush administration had changed the focus of the mission to really focus on human trafficking and religious discrimination. So there's going to be a refocus on race cases, voting rights, and so forth. There's a personnel problem. You all, I'm sure, recall, you know, Monica Goodling, one of the apparatchiks who worked with the Office of Legal Counsel under Attorney General Gonzalez. She was actually a very young and inexperienced lawyer, but was given the amazing portfolio of having the ability to recommend the hiring and firing of various people, including members of the Justice Department. And that hiring and firing happened in a way that was really obscene. People who she didn't regard as real Americans were booted out, and there was a very strict political litmus test that resulted in not only in people being kicked out, but in so many people leaving because the work conditions there were made untenable for people who work in the department, career people in the department who have a commitment to civil rights and who found that, you know, the good cases were being taken away from them, that the mission had changed. Morale was, in fact, very low.
Sherrilyn, just for one second, we're going to call you right back because there's a really bad connection on this phone. I want to make sure people hear everything you're saying because this is a very important discussion. So give us a second, and all of you stay with us. We're going to call Sherrilyn Ifill right back and hopefully get a little better connection with her. And what we're going to talk about and what we're talking about during the course of this first part of our program is what's going on in the Justice Department in changing civil rights enforcement and how that's going to happen. It's a very difficult thing to do, to change the direction of this department. Many things have happened in that department. They've lost. We'll talk to Sherrilyn about this when she returns here, that the Civil Rights Division lost many of their more qualified attorneys. Sherrilyn, you're back with us? Can you potter up?
Yep.
Hi, Sherrilyn, you there?
I'm here.
Great. We got
better?
You good. Yes, it's better.
So
the question is, one of the things is how does this change take place? One of the things that I read recently was that in the years that President George Bush was running the government and the Department of Justice, his Department of Justice was running the Civil Rights Division, 236 civil rights lawyers from 2003 to 2007 left the Civil Rights Division and they only had 350 lawyers.
Yes. There was a literal bloodletting of the most talented, experienced civil rights lawyers in the Justice Department. You know, years ago when I was a full-time civil rights lawyer at the Legal Defense Fund, the lawyers at the Justice Department were regarded as the most experienced lawyers. They had the background. They had the intense knowledge of what has become a very complicated area of law. And nothing could be better than when the Justice Department decided to intervene in a civil rights case that we were doing as lawyers for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, because it meant that resources and know-how and experience were going to be introduced into the litigation. Well, under the Bush administration, the Civil Rights Division was very deliberately really under siege, under attack, with the most experienced attorneys and the most effective civil rights attorneys marginalized, with the mission of the work changed from focusing on race cases to focusing on human trafficking cases and religious discrimination, and with a number of individuals really pushed to the point where they were so demoralized they had to leave because they could not function, ethically as attorneys in the Justice Department in the way that it was being conducted under the Bush administration. And the consequences of that are quite devastating because it means that many of those people have left and will not return, that we've lost them from the Justice Department. They're in other places. Some are returning, and the effort is to try and rebuild the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department to be the kind of top-flight civil rights law firm that it was before the administration of George W. Bush.
So when you have a situation where the Republicans in the U.S. Congress, the Senate, are holding up the appointment of the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, who would oversee all this, Tom
yeah.
Perez, who is now our Secretary of Labor here in the state of Maryland.
Yes.
And that holds them their ability up to change the people that were put into place by George Bush to change the department around. Though President Obama has raised the budget of the Civil Rights Division by 18% so they can hire new lawyers. But this is go ahead.
This is an important point you're raising, Mark, because, you know, it even relates to this issue of Attorney General Holder deciding to appoint a kind of special prosecutor to look at the CIA torture issue. And you'll note that many Republicans have said, you know, why can't career lawyers in the Justice Department look at this? I think one of the issues that people are forgetting is that a lot of the President George W. Bush appointees were appointed to career spots. In other words, they moved out these lawyers who had been there for 15, 20, 25 years, not as political appointees. The political appointees at the Justice Department always come and go with each administration. But the career appointees, they are the folks who stay there over time. That's why they have so much knowledge and experience, because they're there across administrations, Republican and Democrat. And those folks have always largely remained undisturbed. But the effort really was to change the face of the career attorneys. The Bush administration folks didn't trust the career attorneys. They regarded them as lefties, pinkos. I mean, if you actually read the Inspector General's report, it's just appalling.
They said we're not real Americans. We're looking for real Americans.
Exactly. They're looking for real Americans. And so there were a number of instances in which attorneys were kind of really put upon. They would you know, demoralize an attorney by transferring them out of the division they'd been in or taking away important cases from them. And so they moved into those career positions, lots of Bush administration folks. What makes a position a career position is that it's covered by civil service law, and that means that those people cannot be simply fired merely by the fact that President Obama has come into office and has a new assistant attorney general for civil rights or attorney general. So there are lots of Bush lawyers, it is suspected, who are what we call embedded still in the Justice Department. They're still lurking in there. And I personally think that may be one of the reasons why Attorney General Holder was reluctant to assign the CIA torture probe to career attorneys in the Justice Department, because he's still cleaning house, figuring out who's who. And then as it relates to the Civil Rights Division, you're absolutely right. Tom Perez is my former colleague at the University of Maryland Law School, and who's also our former Secretary of Labor and Licensing. He's being held up. This is the punishment that Republicans are meting out for the fact that Attorney General Holder is trying to deal with some of these embeds in the civil service positions at the Justice Department and trying to root some of that out. Now, some of it could be that they want those people to stick around for as long as they can until they can find new jobs. And in this economy, the turnover is going to be low no matter what, because normally, you know, those folks would have opportunities in the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, they're there. And there are a number of people who simply do not trust that these attorneys are on board with the mission of the new administration. And so there's some worry about that. And that's why the budget was increased, so that even if Attorney General Holder's unable to get some of these folks out, or if these folks decide not to leave, he will still be able to add personnel who can work on the core mission of the Justice Department as it's been understood for decades.
So what do you think will happen in this new Civil Rights Division? What do you think is going to be, what do you think the priorities will become, and what do you think they'll go after?
Well, I don't think they're going to, you know, drop some of the initiatives. Certainly human trafficking is important and religious discrimination is important, but they have
made it very clear, Attorney General Holder has made it very clear, that they intend to return to the core civil rights cases. Housing discrimination is a big one. It's gotten very little press outside of New York, but Attorney General Holder and his Justice Department have been working on and finally accomplished the largest housing discrimination settlement in a very long time in Westchester County, New York, requiring Westchester County, this is the Tony suburb outside New York City, and it's going to require them to build affordable housing in Westchester County. I'm talking about Scarsdale and these other bedroom communities. Mm-hmm. This is a huge, major civil rights victory that, as I said, has gotten a lot of attention in the New York area, but not very much outside of New York.
Right.
And this settlement was pushed and negotiated by Attorney General Holder's lawyers in the Justice Department. So we're going to see the return to that kind of core mission. And I think it's important because, you know, some of the stuff that people talk about in terms of Obama and race is kind of like what he says. But I think we should recognize that he's the president of the United States, and we should be focused on what he does. And the Justice Department is a key place where the president can really make some moves that will address racial inequities in the United States.
Now, the New York Times in its editorial called for the new division, Civil Rights Division, to tackle predatory lending and financial bias against minorities.
Yes, and actually, you know, Baltimore is on the cutting edge with this,
right,
with the suit that it filed against Wells Fargo Bank. And there are a number of institutions that are looking at this. We used to call it predatory lending. Now people call it, you know, subprime mortgages and so forth. Mm-hmm. But it's all of a piece. It's all part of the same thing. And there does need to be the resources. These cases are very, very difficult to research and to bring. And this is the kind of work that really sometimes can only be done effectively by the Justice Department because they have the resources. And so the hope is that this Justice Department will begin to give some attention to those issues, which are critically important, but which are under-resourced and very difficult for private groups to handle themselves.
Now, I wonder, the thing I'm not sure whether politically this is going to set up, the dynamic is going to set up, because you're already seeing people in the conservative movement and people in the Republican Party in Congress angry at the Civil Rights Division because dropping when it went to kind of minimize the case against the new Black Panther Party in Alabama,
yeah,
going after,
yeah,
the Arizona sheriff on immigration, blocking the rule requiring Georgia to approve a citizenship, and things like that. This is, you're seeing the bad lines being drawn in a very serious way here.
Well, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, I think one of the problems is that, you know, there's almost been a, and that's a result somewhat of what's happened over the Bush years, but also a result, I think, of some of our excitement over the election of the first Black president, where people seem to be confused as to whether or not there are still civil rights issues that require attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you're going to see as Eric Holder ramps up the work of the Justice Department to return to, you know, its core mission and to return to the reason that it was created in the late 1950s, is going to begin to show us in fairly stark relief that there is a civil rights agenda, and it's also going to show us that there is opposition to that civil rights agenda. And so I actually think, in that sense, it's healthy. The fact that, you know, many of these efforts are being resisted by some of the Republicans, I think it's just fine, because it shows us that there really is an issue here, that there is, you know, work to be done still in the arena of civil rights. There are those who are resisting having that work be done. And as we see in the Westchester County case, the president and the Justice Department can make a difference in the lives of, you know, average racial minorities. And so I think it's important for us to see this. And hopefully it will refocus some attention and help people to really understand that we still need to be ever vigilant in the area of civil rights.
Sherrilyn Ifill, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I want to thank you so much for taking the time today, and we look,
sure,
forward to having you back in
the
soon.
Sorry for the bad connection. I hope it came through.
It came through well. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Sherrilyn Ifill, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, author of the book On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas. This month, Urbanite goes back to school with a learning issue, featuring reports on the future of high-stakes testing, new approaches to the dropout crisis, and challenges of teaching behind bars. Urbanite is available at over 750 locations. We take back a very short break now. When we come back, we'll be joined by Dr. Arnold Rellman, professor emeritus of medicine and social medicine at Harvard Medical School and former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, talking about the healthcare crisis from a very interesting perspective. Stay with us. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we're about to have a conversation with Dr. Arnold Relman. He and Dr. Marsha Angel wrote a letter to the editor about seeking choice in healthcare reform. Dr. Relman is professor emeritus of medicine and social medicine at Harvard Medical College. He and Dr. Angel were both at one point editors-in-chief of the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine. And I was very taken by their letter, having interviewed Dr. Angel before a few years ago, and was looking forward to having this conversation to expand on the letter that they wrote. We talked to call Dr. Relman, and we just went through his New York Review of Books, which you can see on our website right now, an article called "The Healthcare Reform We Need Are Not Getting." And Dr. Arnold Relman, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
It's a pleasure. So let me let you begin to outline this, the problem as you see it. You start to outline the political problem, and then you begin to outline the problem of healthcare costs in a pretty succinct way. But why don't you begin to, if you could, before we talk about the politics of what's going on, to outline from your perspective why we spend 70% of U.S. GDP in 2008 and rising on healthcare, and from your perspective.
Right. Well, there are essentially two problems now with the U.S. healthcare system, which is in bad trouble. The first problem is that there are a lot of people who have no insurance at all, and many more that are underinsured. The estimates of the uninsured population vary, but most people think somewhere around 45 to 50 million people at any one time in this country are without insurance, and probably many more than that are inadequately insured so that a major illness would wipe them out and perhaps throw them into bankruptcy. The second big problem is, and it's related to the first, is that the whole system costs much too much. We spend, as a country, more than twice as much on the average than most other advanced countries. And there's a lot of evidence that we're not getting our money's worth, that the average quality of U.S. health care is not as good as the average quality of health care in many advanced countries. The best U.S. health care is great, but only a few people are lucky enough to get the best. So that's the problem. Why is U.S. healthcare so expensive? Well, there are many reasons, but in my opinion, the most important reason is that we've turned healthcare into a business, into an industry. We're the only country in the world that has done that. So profit and generating income become at least as important as serving the medical needs of patients. Now, industries, businesses thrive only by growing. And when the healthcare industry grows, when hospitals and clinics and diagnostic centers and practicing physicians increase their income and all the incentives in the system make them want to do that, that increases the cost to those of us who have to pay for healthcare. So this is a problem that's not generally appreciated, but I'm convinced it's fundamental. We treat health care as a business, and that's why we pay so much for it, because there are huge costs of overhead and profit and marketing and advertising and even fraud and a duplication and fragmentation, which come from essentially unregulated business-dominated industry.
So if we could, I mean, I'd like to kind of really let the public understand the argument you're making about specifically how this investment takes place and how much it costs our healthcare system. I mean, you write in your article about the investors now own about 20% of the non-public general hospitals, and that it has changed literally the nature of how hospitals operate in America and how that affects healthcare costs.
Investors are found everywhere in the healthcare industry. It's true that only 20% of the general hospitals in this country are owned by investor-owned companies, but they create a climate in which other hospitals have to compete for market share, so that at the present time, almost all American hospitals, whether they're for-profit or not-for-profit, act as if they were for-profit. That is to say, they're driven by the same economic incentives that drive their competitors in the investor-owned industry. Now, all the rest of U.S. healthcare, all the huge amount of ambulatory services, and by the way, we're now spending much more money on outpatient and ambulatory facilities than we are on hospitals.
And many of those, you're arguing, and people argue, are privately owned.
Most of them are. That's
right.
My point.
Right, right.
The hospitals are only 20%, but the majority of specialty hospitals, the majority of diagnostic clinics, the majority of ambulatory surgical services, dialysis centers, you name it, nursing homes, are all investor-owned. And that's not seen anywhere else in the world. And these industries drive, naturally, they drive to meet the expectations of their investors. They want to make more money, and that costs us a lot of money because they have huge overheads, and they're all practicing independently. They don't cooperate. There's no uniform, integrated organization of services, so it's very inefficient.
We're talking with Dr. Arnold Relman, who is a professor emeritus of medicine and social medicine from Harvard Medical School and a former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, and talking about his article he had in the New York Review of Books on July 2nd, which you can find on our website, called Health Reform We Need and Are Not Getting. I'm curious, as I read this, one thing I'd like to find out is, how and when did this begin from your perspective? I remember, as a very young man, I remember my father, a physician, ENT, at a small hospital, small practice, and then all of a sudden the world began to change in terms of where medicine went. Could talk about what you think happened and why medicine changed.
Well, I'm probably older than you are, Mark. I'm older than most physicians in practice. I began to practice medicine in 1949.
About the age of my father then, same age.
And I've watched it all happen. And you're right. In the 40s and 50s, and even in the early part of the 60s, this was not the case. Medicine was mainly practiced by private physicians. It's true they practiced on a fee-for-service basis, and that, in one sense, made them businessmen, but not really, because there was no competition for patients. The availability of high technology and expensive services, and the availability of money to pay for all of these expensive services, didn't appear till later. It really started when, after World War II, private insurance began to increase through employment, and in 1966, Medicare and Medicaid came on the scene, and the amount of insurance money that was poured into the healthcare system increased enormously, and now doctors could bill for services without worrying whether their patients could pay. When I started out in practice in 1950, you talked to patients and you asked them what they could afford, and you decided what to do for them in part on the basis of what was reasonable in terms of their ability to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And things didn't cost that much. But now everything is more expensive. The majority, roughly 85% of what's spent on health care is paid by insurance companies. The patients don't pay. There are enormously expensive tests, and all of this has driven stimulated the rise of specialized medicine. When I started out, at least half of the doctors were generalists, primary care doctors, general physicians, pediatricians, family physicians. Now the great majority of doctors are specialists, depending for their living on high technology and procedures. And, of course, they get paid much more for doing procedures than just talking to patients and examining them. And all the institutions that the ambulatory services and the hospitals that provide these services are being paid much more money the more they do. So the whole thing is geared to stimulate volume, to provide more and more. Now, let's face it, some of it is obviously needed to treat people, and the technology we have now and the services that we can provide are much, much more effective than they were when I started out. I don't want to confuse your listeners about that, but we can provide better health care. But overlaying that is an enormous amount of additional service, elective services, duplicated services that are provided simply because they're there, because they're paid for, and because somebody is going to make a profit from doing it. And I'm not the only one who perceives this. I was probably the first person to point it out, because in 1980, I wrote an article in the New England Journal when I was the editor called The New Medical Industrial Complex. And I think I was the first person to point out that healthcare was becoming an industry and all the consequences. But since then, there's been an enormous amount of literature and study by people in all of all specialized fields agreeing that that medicine has become industrialized, and the best estimates by the best experts are that at least a third of all the money that we spend on health care, and it's now $2.5 trillion, at least a third and maybe more, it does not go towards providing necessary, useful, helpful medical services. As I say, it's overhead, it's waste, it's duplication, it could be eliminated easily without impairing the quality of health care. Indeed, it would make health care better. Now, we're talking, if that number is right, we're talking about $700 or $800 billion that we're wasting. And it's increasing all the time.
So I'd like to, before I come back to the arguments you make about Dr. Emanuel's book and why that you think it only goes part of the way and your problems with the whole President Obama's plan to change healthcare in America, I want you to talk a bit about and introduce to our listeners the work of Dr. Kenneth Arrow, the Nobel laureate that you write about in your article, and what he was saying.
Economists really didn't concern themselves with health care until the money began to pour in, as I say, in the late 50s and early 60s, as insurance increased and more money poured in. The economists began to say, hey, this is something we ought to look at, because economists are obviously interested in anything that where a lot of money is involved. And probably the first scholar in economics to study health care was Professor Kenneth Arrow, who was then a young professor at Stanford University. Subsequently, he won the Nobel Prize in economics for his brilliant research. And he wrote a paper in the American Economic Review in 1963, in which he looked at the healthcare system as a market. Is it really a market, as economists think about it? And he decided it wasn't a market, because all the forces that play in a market, the balancing tensions between provider and supplier, and the role of price, and the importance of the consumer having information about the usefulness and value to him or her of the service or product he's buying, doesn't apply in medicine. In medicine, when you're sick or you're injured or you're scared and you're worried you might have something bad, you go to a doctor, and you're dependent on the doctor's advice as to what's wrong with you or what might be wrong with you and what needs to be done. And while I and most physicians now believe that patients should take a lot of interest in their own health and welfare, should be as well informed as possible, should be discussing decisions with their doctors, I'm all for that. The fact remains is that you basically, when you're sick and injured, dependent on decisions made by doctors. The doctors supply the services, they get paid for the services, they tell the hospitals and the clinics and so on what tests to use, whether you need to be in the hospital, whether you need to be x-rayed or operated on. And the consumer doesn't make all that much of a decision. Furthermore, most of the cost is not paid by the consumer. It's paid by the insurance company. And finally, as Arrow pointed out, consumers, when they consult a doctor, are not like shoppers walking down the aisles of a department store and looking at goods and services at different prices and quality and deciding whether they want it and when they want it and whether the price is right and the quality is right. You don't do that when you're sick. You don't say, doctor, give me the cheapest cut rate brain surgery you've got, or what's your special today. You say, doctor, please take care of me. Do what's necessary. Protect my life. Protect my health. It's a totally different kind of market. And Arrow said, for that reason, the laws of economics cannot apply, and the principles of Adam Smith and the free market will not protect the interests of the consumer. We have to have other protections, and he said we do, in fact. We have medicine as a profession and the regulation of medicine as a profession. We have the law, we have the public expectation that medicine is a serving profession. And that's what we have to rely on, not on the workings of the market. But what Arrow said, as profound and as true as it was soon overlooked, because shortly after he published his article, Medicare and Medicaid came in. Vast amounts of money went into health care. Investors began to jump into take the opportunity to make money. The same people who started Kentucky Fried Chicken started hospital chains. And it became a money game after that. It became an investor's playground.
We're talking with Dr. Arnold Rillman, who is the Professor Emeritus of Medicine and Social Medicine at Harvard School of Medicine, former Editor-in-Chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. We're talking about his article that appeared in the July issue of New York Review of Books, July 2nd, Healthcare, the Health Reform We Need and Are Not Getting. So it's really, I want to explore then how we unravel this. I mean, if on one hand Medicare and Medicaid were passed to ensure that the poorest of Americans and elderly Americans have their health care paid for.
It was a great advance. It was a great social advance.
It was also the birth of all these, beginning of the birth of all these private, for-profit and non-profit insurance
That's
companies
right.
at the
because
same time.
Private insurance was expanding and was following the Medicare's example, paying on a fee-for-service, item-by-item basis, whatever the providers said they should be paid. And they didn't question it because the premiums could be raised, and they were raised every year, 8%, 10%, 12% a year to cover the costs. Well, my prescription for solving the problem is something that I think is extremely simple. It's not rocket science. It's very logical, very common sense. But it's amazing that no health reform proposal now being considered in Washington or even being discussed by many other experts faces up to it. My solution is to change the incentives for doctors by encouraging, giving them incentives and support to form not-for-profit, multi-specialty group practices like the Mayo Clinic and like the Cleveland Clinic, although smaller and community-based, not-for-profit, multi-specialty groups pay the doctors a fixed amount of money per patient and say, doctor, for this amount of money, we expect you to provide all the necessary care. And you will be paid a salary, and you cannot increase your salary or your income by providing more service or holding back services, because your salary as a percentage of the total amount of money you're going to get paid will be fixed. How you divide it up between specialists and general physicians is your business, and that, of course, is a big problem, because mm-hmm. the specialists get all the money, and we don't have any primary care doctors. But in these group clinics, in these multi-specialty clinics, they pay the primary care doctors very well, and they have an appropriate mix and balance, and all the doctors work together to provide patients with good care. How do we pay for it? Very simple. We say we're going to have a special earmarked health care tax, a progressive tax. If you're really poor, you won't pay. If you're rich, you'll pay a higher percentage. But a health care tax, which will pay for the total cost of all the necessary care, and it will be paid on a per capita, per each patient basis, prepaid. And that way, we, through our representatives in Congress, will decide how much money we want to spend on health care. Everybody will be in. Nobody will be out. Everybody will be in. Everybody will be covered. And we'll say to the doctors, do what you're supposed to do, what you're trained to do, what your profession requires you to do. Take the best possible care of us in the most efficient, sensible, compassionate way you can, involving your patients in discussions. We're not going to tell you how to practice. We're not going to tell you, we're not going to regulate what you can do and what you can't do. We're just going to tell you how much money we can afford to pay for health care.
Well, let me ask this question, though. I mean, there's a lot of questions I have about this, and a number of them. Let me just take them one by one, if I might. How does that address the problem of the privatization of healthcare, when you said that 20% of non-public general hospitals are owned by investors,
yes.
and
yes.
that nonprofit hospitals are also competing in the marketplace, like Hopkins in Maryland here in this community, act as if they're for-profit because they're
sure.
competing against MedStar and everybody else.
They advertise, else. They market, of course. Yes.
And then you still have the health insurance companies where they
well, in the system that I envision, private health insurance has no role. And I would see, I mean, the details would have to be worked out gradually. I don't believe the government can or should simply confiscate the private property of the insurance the private insurance companies. They've got to be compensated for their equity interest and gradually eased out of the picture. But private for-profit health insurance is an anachronism. It adds nothing but extra expense to the healthcare system. So that's got to be dispensed with. Now, whether we allow private for-profit clinics and diagnostic centers and hospitals and nursing homes, dialysis centers to continue is a matter, I think, that has to be worked out. The important point is that how much they will be paid will be determined by the budget that doctors have available to work with. And I think doctors and their patients together collectively are the best judge of which providers provide the best service and for the best value for the money. They should be given the money through this this central prepayment mechanism to pay the providers if for-profit providers can compete with price and provide these doctor groups with good service for their patients, fine. I doubt that they can. I have studied this problem extensively over the years. There's not a shred of evidence that private for-profit facilities are better or more efficient than not-for-profit facilities, comparable, and usually they're more expensive. So I don't think they're going to be able to compete, but let them try.
So we also have the issue in America, as you point out in parts of your article, about the hospital system. We've always had a system in America of large or small non-for-profit hospitals that exist in this country. We used to have a system of municipal and public hospitals
yes.
that have been destroyed.
Yes.
Every hospital had a municipal public hospital. Every city, yes. I mean, had a municipal, yes, public hospital as well.
Yeah. You had, well, a public... I think that in the system that I envision, that the distinction between not-for-profit community hospitals and public hospitals should disappear. In a sense, the not-for-profit community hospital is a public hospital. There should be no investors. A board of trustees, their job is to provide good care at a price that is acceptable to the public, that fits in. And the teaching hospitals, the Johns Hopkins and the Mass Generals of this world, have to get extra money through the system because they provide... Johns Hopkins does more than a community hospital in terms of teaching and research and, mm-hmm, and developing cutting-edge new treatment. So they need more money. That can come from the central fund. Remember, Mark, I started out by saying there's about $700 or $800 billion that we're now spending,
mm-hmm,
that we're not getting any money, our money's worth, and could be eliminated in an efficient system. That money, that $700 or $800 billion now, could be used, A, to pay for the costs of the 50 million people who are uninsured, and also could be used to pay for the extra costs of the academic medical centers and the research and teaching hospitals that we need. There'd be plenty of money. The problem in the United States, Mark, is not that we can't afford to have the best healthcare system in the world. It's just that the money is not the problem. The problem is the system that we have is terrible. It wastes money. It's unfair, and we don't get our money's worth. In other countries, the bad mouthing of Canada and the UK,
yes,
and so on, so-called socialized,
right,
countries, because of waiting lists and rationing,
right,
a lot of that simply is not true. I've been around, I've studied, a lot of it is just lies and exaggeration. But it is true that there is limitation of resources. It is true that there's waiting. And the problem is that in these other countries, they don't spend enough money. They have a good system. They have the right idea. Everybody should be covered. Nobody should go broke because you're sick. Everybody should have access to health care. But they don't spend enough money. If Canada, for example, spent nearly almost as much money as we spent on health care as a fraction of our economy, they'd have the best health care system in the world.
So your argument in many ways is the problem is not that we spend 17% of our GDP on health care, it's how we spend it.
Exactly. We can afford what we're doing now. What we can't afford is the constant inflation. And what's killing us, what's going to destroy the system unless we control it, is the constant inflation. We're increasing the amount of money we spend on health care by an average of 6 to 8% per year. Any economist who looks at that agrees that's murderous. We cannot support that much longer.
So I wonder in your thinking about all this, I mean, that just as you look at what has been happening in these alleged town meetings,
yeah,
and in the push by, because we haven't even talked about pharmaceuticals and the role they play in this,
yes,
and the cost of that,
which, yeah,
I'd like to hear your thoughts on in just a minute. But when you see the fear of government being kind of raised,
yeah,
as the pillar of defense against this healthcare reform.
Well, that's ridiculous. You know, I mean, it's been inflamed by zealots on the right who believe that government can't do anything right. We have now government-run, socialized police services, fire services. We have a government-run regulation of Wall Street, not enough but necessary. We have government-regulated post office. We have government-regulated national parks, Coast Guard, military, VA service. The VA medical service is probably the best medical service there is in the country,
mm-hmm,
and that's all government-run. So the hysteria about government control is just that. It's hysteria whipped up by people who either are so ideologically blinkered and thinking about government can't do anything right, Or else, and this is more and more the case, they have a financial interest in maintaining the status quo. They're making a lot of money. And most of the people who are funding and who are behind, the lobbyists and the industries that are funding all of this town hall hysteria, are making money from the current health care system.
So I wonder, given, I mean, this is, it's voices of clarity in this debate are having a hard time getting through.
Yes, unfortunately.
And even as you point out, and as many who probably voted for president, for Barack Obama for president of the United States of America point out, that in this is conversations about health care, that in some ways the opposition to the health care reform are correct in saying that the way President Obama is talking about paying for health care doesn't work.
I'm afraid so. I mean, you know, I voted for Obama hoping and believing that he was going to be able to do something to turn the situation around. He is so committed to trying to reach consensus. He is so, up until now, so unwilling to take a stand. Franklin Roosevelt, when the New Deal came in, did not try to reach a consensus. Franklin Roosevelt understood that there was going to be implacable conservative opposition to all the reforms that he felt was necessary to save the national economy and restore confidence in the country. He just went ahead and he said, "Okay, I know you're going to hate me, and I'm proud of the fact that a lot of bad people hate me." And the majority, not everybody, but the majority of people supported him. I think if Obama took some of that advice from Roosevelt's example and said, look, this is what I was elected on. The majority, not everybody will agree with me, but the majority want to see major change. The health care system is obviously broken. Nobody denies that. Even the Republicans admit. But they just don't want Obama to get what he wants. They want the administration to be discredited. So they're naysaying, they're objecting, on every possible ground. But they have no solution that makes any sense and would do anything to improve the situation. So Obama must recognize that he can't bring everybody along. He's got to explain what he wants. I hope this Wednesday, in his talk before the joint session of Congress, he'll be explicit about what he thinks is important and why, and press for it. And I think the majority of people want it. Even the majority of my profession, the medical profession, it's very interesting. The medical profession historically has been very conservative and been
yes.
very suspicious of government interference. The AMA, of course, which no longer represents the majority of doctors. It represents at most 30% of doctors, but still is an important political voice. The AMA is coming around. The AMA was historically always opposed to all kinds of government initiatives, now says it favors H.R. 3200, which is the House of Representatives bill.
Right.
Which has a lot of government initiative.
That's but the public plan still exists in that bill.
Right.
Right.
Now, of course, the AMA is opposed to that. But the fact is that doctors are recognizing the system is broken. They recognize that they're in the middle of it. No reform that doesn't involve the doctors in helping to make it better, that doesn't put doctors in the center of the stage and say, doctors, we'll tell you how much money you can spend. We're going to tell you totally what the total budget is, but we're not going to second guess you. We're not going to practice medicine. You and your patients decide what's best with the money that we can afford, that we think we can afford. And what I'm saying is that the evidence is very clear that judging from what we're already spending, we can afford to cover everybody with very good health care, no sweat at all. The problem is not the money in this country. It's that we have a terrible system. We've gotten off on the wrong foot. We think that medicine is just another business, and that's destroying the American healthcare system.
We've been talking to Dr. Arnold Relman. His article is in the New York Review of Books, published on July 2nd, 2009, called Health, The Health Reform We Need and Not Getting. You can find it on our website at steinershow.org, the link to that. He is Professor Emeritus of Medicine and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School and is the former Editor-in-Chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. And this show was inspired by the article that he and Dr. Marcia Angell wrote as a letter to the editor in the New York Times on August the 30th. And Dr. Relman, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, Mark. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered at WEAA by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, and Devin Finley. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.